Well, not quite. I'll be talking about more than just the Benjamins. Welcome to FinTech Beat, where finance, technology, and policy come together. I'm your host, Chris Brummer, and the future of finance is now.
On October 19th, 2023, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau released a proposal on personal financial data rights, CFPB Rule 1033, which is intended to accelerate a shift towards open banking in the United States and along the way empowers consumers with the rights to receive structured, consistent, and timely access to their personal financial data held by financial institutions that they can in turn pass along to their fintech services providers. Now, this rule promises to be a watershed in banking regulations. Longtime FinTech Beat listeners will know that we've covered the topic extensively on the podcast and offered 101 lessons for people to help them get up to speed. But now that the writing is quite literally on the proverbial wall, I wanted to delve deeper and get a sense as to the nuts and bolts and reception of the rules in the banking community. And I am delighted that Ramon Gomez, JP Morgan's Managing Director for Regulatory Affairs, along with Ravi Govindaraju, the head of Connected Banking at Chase, have made themselves available to discuss the rule, as well as to dissect the regulatory landscape. So sit back and enjoy what I promise will be an eye-opening conversation around open banking and what recent rules may mean for consumer protection, competition, and innovation. Ramon, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Ravi, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. So when I hear the word regulatory affairs, I know what that means. You're the head honcho, Ramon, when it comes to interactions with the government. But Ravi, what in the world does connected banking even mean? If I didn't know any better, I think I should actually be taking your title literally.
Thanks again, Chris, for having me on. And so it's a great question. So my organization at Chase is responsible for building digital products that empower customers with managing their finances and thinking about their financial health. So that can range from insights related to their spending, tools to help them create and manage a budget, things related to their credit score, you know, what is your credit score, transparency around how to actually manage their credit score and improve it over time, savings related tools, identity monitoring, other sort of personal financial management offerings. While doing that, we also do understand that many of our customers don't just bank with us, they also bank with several other financial institutions. And so when trying to make decisions regarding your financial health, financial life, you do need to bring all of that data together to get a holistic picture. And so we also build products to allow customers to bring in information from other institutions and apps so that you can leverage the tools we're building in the Chase ecosystem and, you know, put all of your data together and get a full picture of your financial life. Conversely, you may want to share your Chase data out with other third-party apps that have similar or other products that you're interested in. And we want to make it as easy and seamless as possible for customers to share that data, but at the same time, making sure that their security and their privacy is protected in the process of doing that and that they remain in control through that process.
So you're the open banking guy.
I would not use the term, but I would say I'm the guy who allows customers to permission and share their data out to third parties.
Okay. So, you know, what I find really interesting both in your title and sort of what the topic today that, you know, we're talking about and obviously that the CFPB is trying to deal with is this a little bit of an evolution in banking, right? Like, you know, it's no longer just the place where you go to get loans. It sounds like, you know, banking is now the place where you go to get information and to get information apparently about yourself. Right. So, you know, when you think about that data, right, that a consumer is trying to get in your words to sort of plan their financial lives and the like, you know, where does that sort of fit in terms of the services that your modern customer is seeking to access?
what I would say is, like, you know, like, whether it's your bank or other third party apps, we totally recognize and find, you know, totally see value in the fact that there are innovations being done across the industry that a customer can benefit from. So whether that's you know, personal financial management that we talked about, money movement, tax preparation, investing. There's a bunch of, you know, really cool stuff going on across the ecosystem. And in order to leverage those capabilities, customers have to be able to share out the data that a bank might have, you know, their financial information with those third-party apps to do that in order to really leverage those services. And so we feel it's incumbent on us to make it as easy as possible for customers to share that data, because we want them to get value from those services. We, like I talked about, you know, my team builds several similar sort of offerings within the Chase ecosystem, and we compete with some of the third-party apps on what those are. But at the end of the day, you know, it's a customer's decision on what they'd like to use, and we want to make sure that we make it as easy and as possible for them to do that. But also making sure that we really truly protect them in the process of doing that, because things can go really wrong in today's world when you're trying to share data out without truly knowing who it's going to, how it's going to be used, how often are they going to come get your data on your behalf, and all of those things. So we want to make sure there's transparency, there's control, there's security. But at the end of the day, we want to allow them to get as much benefit across the ecosystem as they can.
So I don't want to get the cart before the horse by you know, jumping to this before discussing the kind of contours of the rule, especially since we do have, you know, the regulatory guru and head honcho with us for that discussion. But just when it comes to things like CFPB rules, is part of your role also to sort of anticipate, you know, what's coming down the pike, or do you just build those services, and then, you know, it's kind of like adjusting as you go, as you get new information from Washington?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, Ramon and I work hand in hand often, and so, you know, we're always looking ahead to what might be coming down and making sure that we're thinking of our customers in that lens. And, you know, I'd be proud to say that from a Chase perspective, we've probably led the industry on this. We were one of the first banks to shift away from screen scraping to APIs, and, you know, we're sort of proud of saying that there's no screen scrapers that come into our ecosystem today, and we've sort of influenced the regulation to sort of say, hey, like, we need to shift to APIs. And so it's not just anticipating what might be coming down from Washington, but also sharing out what we've seen as technological advancements that are in the best interests of our customers, and trying to make sure that that is done in a way that can be expanded across the ecosystem and used across the ecosystem.
Excellent. Okay, so Ramon, given all of that information, maybe you could provide a 10,000-foot sort of summary for those FinTech Beat listeners who may have missed some of the earlier episodes on open banking, to give us sort of an overview on 1033, and to really provide us with some sense as to what the rules or the proposed rules want, and then maybe even a little bit of that backstory, because it's really taken quite a while for the proposed sort of rules to kind of make its way through the system.
Thank you, Chris. And that's a really good question, because that time span that elapsed from the enactment of Dodd-Frank to today means that what Congress was thinking about then is very different from what open banking is today. And in fact, open banking came after 1033 was enacted. I actually was part of some of the Dodd-Frank negotiations. But as you said, Dodd-Frank was, you know, part of 1033 was part of Dodd-Frank, and it was intended in very few words. It's about 75 words, depending how you count. I'm not an accountant, but it requires covered persons, which are entities providing consumer financial product or service, to make available to the customer data about those services provided. And at the time, the goal was very simple. It was what was then Mint. It was what was preparing your taxes. It was the ability to connect maybe some of the original aggregators that allowed you to see all your financial picture in one place. That was it. And it was not until Europe started adopting open banking and various commenters started writing about open banking in the US that the concept of open banking was connected to 1033. And Now, when you look at the vision of Chopra 12 years later or 13 years later, with everything that has transpired since then, think about where we were in financial apps then and where we are today. Now, that experience kind of post hoc informs what we think 1033 is. And we call it open banking, and we talk about frictionless data sharing, account portability, payments, and sparing competition. I mean, some of those things actually are part of what 1033 intended. So the notion that you could use your cash flow data to underwrite loans was something that at the time people said, wow, this could help. And that was a great thing. And we're doing great work with that at Chase to help people who may not have traditional credit. So that's a great use that was there, but it was not called open banking. It was really cash flow underwriting. And the same thing was to see your financial picture. It was really for portfolio management and to help you with the chore of collecting paper that used to go into your TurboTax, for instance. Now you could just download everything into an Excel spreadsheet and load it into your tax preparation software. So part of it is it's contextual to what people expected 1033 to do. But open banking with all the things that now are envisioned is really kind of a bootstrapping of something that came after 1033 was enacted.
So what does that then mean sort of in terms of implementation and in terms of reception? So Robbie was already talking a little bit about, hey, look, you know, like, yeah, obviously there are questions about whether or not any consumer can get the data that they may want, right? There's that sort of basic question. Then there's the question about to whom is that either or given or with whom is that information shared, as well as from whom can you pull that information, right? So you have these basic sort of push-pull features. Is there anything in sort of the evolution of, frankly, fintech, which is what you're pointing to, that's allowed open banking to kind of grow beyond what was anticipated originally in 1033? Like, what does that mean when it comes to the writing on the wall, when it comes to the actual implementation of those rules? What parts are, for lack of a word, easily integrated? And then what parts are sort of the harder parts for folks to navigate?
So I think Ravi told you that we compete with fintech apps. That's part of his DNA in what he does. And so our customers expect certain performance from their financial apps that is comparable to what they get elsewhere. So the technology is changing to allow that. And the use of APIs is essential, for instance, because when you have a screen scraper, you just have someone who uses your credentials to come into your account, grab all the data they can, and could do harm to you. Now, the use of APIs is essential because it allows us to do three very important things. Number one, it allows us to bind, to confirm that the customer wants to provide access to an app, bind that consent to specific apps that she wants to show. So it's, you know, what accounts do you want to show for this app? And then the API allows us to do something that's really important to the CFPB, which is preserve customer control. You go to our security center, and now you can see who you're sharing your data with, what apps and what accounts. And you can modify access or revoke access at any time. You know, we have this view here that probably is very familiar to you or anyone else. We call it amnesia, which it means that you sign up for all sorts of things, for services and so forth, and you're sharing your data, but you forget about it. The use of the API really allows you to remain in control and always be able to look at who is accessing your financial data, which is incredibly important, and that include some of your most personal transaction information. And that's fundamental. And then the final thing it allows you to do is ensure that there is a safety element in that sharing, because you no longer have an app coming in with your credentials, snooping around the entirety of your account, possibly starting transactions or doing other things, you now have a very small packet of data that is connected to a use case that exits the firm for only the purpose that the consumer really intended to provide that app access to.
So, okay, when you look at all that, and again, you know, the fintech issue is really pretty interesting, and I think I'll rotate back to it in just a second. But as the rule has, you know, was first proposed and where we are now, I mean, this is, you know, since you were at the front lines with Dodd-Frank and those the sort of initial brief wording in Dodd-Frank, what was your, sort of impression, you know, when you first saw 1033 being proposed? And what's your general reception of the rule? And how do you think many of your colleagues are viewing the new regulations as they're coming into place?
Well, one great thing about the proposed rule is that the CFPB has been listening to the industry, and it recognized the dangers of screen scraping and the benefits of adopting APIs. It was very clear about the value of protecting those interactions. And it spent a lot of ink just talking about that in the rule. The other thing it did was that it recognized the importance of industry-led standards being part of what eventually emerges, and they have adopted this idea of a standard-setting organization, which I think it's really essential to ensure that there's momentum in the creation of use cases and protocols for security and connectivity that can be used across the industry. And right now, over 65 million Americans are using one of those standards called FDX. It also recognized the importance of due diligence and risk management and ensuring that we can do what's necessary to ensure that the entities that have access to our customers' data have certain minimum data handling standards and security standards. And that provides you a mosaic of opportunities to really ensure that you can do as much as possible to protect data that, when it is in the banking environment, is highly protected. And now it's leaving the regulated space into a world where, you know, there are no protections generally.
So what I'm hearing is a little bit of, well, number one, a lot of problems with the screen scraping. We actually had an episode as well with one of my colleagues who sort of went through a little bit of screen scraping. But Ravi, maybe you can, again, remind our audience who missed some of those earlier episodes on the podcast. So what exactly is screen scraping? It sounds like that's one of the major fault lines and one of the challenges or problems that you guys are seeing in terms of how a considerable amount of financial data is collected. And, you know, from a product sort of positioning, how prevalent is screen scraping still?
It's a great question, Chris. And still, you know, I would say across the ecosystem, one of the largest issues that exists as we think of the growth of the permission data sharing ecosystem that continues to exist. So what is screen scraping? Chris wants to share his bank account information with the third-party app, clicks on share my bank account information. What pops up is a screen that looks like your Chase login screen, but it's not actually your Chase app. It's a screen that's been mirrored to look like the Chase app. Chris provides his username and his password. Now, the third-party app has effectively a version of a scraper, a bot, that then goes in, opens up the actual Chase.com website, puts in the username and password, logs in, and then takes information from Chris's account page and presents it back within their third-party app. Now, why did screen scraping actually start, right? There was no way, in fairness, for you to get your information out. So, you know, this is kudos to innovation. Like, there needed to be a way to get information out in order to get all of the benefits that we've talked about already on the show. And so that's how it sort of started about. But, you know, things have changed over the years. I think we've recognized that there is a real need for customers to share their data. There's real value that our customers get from it. And for them to lead better, healthier financial lives, we need to enable to do that. And so, you know, Ramon talked about APIs. The other way to do it is we actually expose an API endpoint for the third-party app to come and connect to. So there's a handshake where they can come in and tell us, hey, Chris wants this information. We then present you, Chris, with your actual Chase login screen. You log in, you're in the Chase ecosystem. You tell us that, hey, I want to grant app XYZ access to this particular data, these set of accounts, and I'm fully comfortable with it. So you authenticate with us, you authorize all of that sharing with us, and we have a record of it. And then your information is shared with that app at a certain frequency. What it also does is puts you in control, because if tomorrow you decide, and you know, Ramon talked about amnesia, oftentimes you got with your friend for a dinner, you wanted to, you know, split the bill, and you have to use a peer-to-peer app to pay your friend. You just sign up, share your account data, make the payment, and then forget about it. When you come back into the Chase ecosystem, we can present you a screen that shows you all the apps that you've ever shared your credentials with or authorized to come get your information. And you can then go in and say, revoke access because I'm no longer using this thing. But you remain in control. In the alternate screen scraping world where you provided your credentials, we can't really help you because we don't know who all you provided your credentials to, and we can't stop them from coming in because they actually have your real credentials. So that's really the basic customer control that we're really returning through APIs and getting away from screen scraping.
You know, I guess that really anticipates, you know, the question that everybody, you know, is concerned about nowadays, which is that question of privacy and in this particular instance, sort of a data leakage and the like. And I think one of the challenges, and certainly some of the sort of harder core fintech listeners will certainly say that, well, you know, it's really important that you have some of these other market participants out there, because what they're doing is they're kind of pushing the envelope on that innovation, right? That yeah, there may be some risk out there, but otherwise you're not able to unlock some value, right? And I think regulators are in that very unenviable position of having to kind of, which they're trying to grapple with even outside of industry, just internally, with sort of risk and reward, and like, how do you optimize on not just risk, but also that reward. You know, I know it's a little bit of a legal question, not just a product one, but maybe I'll just ask you both. How do you look at that, Ravi, in terms of that risk-reward trade-off? And then more on the regulatory issue for Ramon, how does that trade-off look like in the proposed rule? So I guess we'll just start off with you, Ravi.
Look, I mean, in my opinion, I don't think empowering customers and keeping their data safe is mutually exclusive. I think you could truly do both and achieve that goal. You know, going back to my example, ultimately, we want to make sure that it's the customer's data. And the customer has to be fully aware of who's using it. What are all the parties that are going to get access to their data? How often are they going to get their data and what they're going to do with it? And as long as that can be done in a transparent manner and a safe manner, that I think ultimately should be the customer's choice. Our concern really comes in from a product perspective when you are trying to authorize app XYZ to get your bank account information. But what you never realize, Chris, in the process is you've actually shared that information with seven other intermediaries that you didn't even know existed. And so now Chris actually thinks his data is with app XYZ and Chase, but in reality, there are all these intermediaries that have access to Chris's data and could be using it for a multitude of purposes. I don't think that's really fair from Chris's perspective, because it's not really the right thing for you. You never actually authorized for that to happen. And it's actually not dependent on your usage. They're coming in every single day and taking all of your data out, and you don't know where it's going. You don't know how it's going to be used, and you don't know how it's stored. So, it's not just about the privacy component of you not realizing that your data is leaving. You actually don't even know that it's secure. And if there was leakage, this is sensitive financial data we're talking about, it could have real ramifications on you as an individual. And you may even read the press release that a company ABC had a data leak. you may never realize that you were impacted because you didn't even know that they had your data in the first place. So I think like there is a way to really construct this in a way that we make sure the customer remains in control, but at the same time truly shares their data and gets gets the benefit of it. You sort of led off the podcast just talking about open banking and the sort of broader perspective that 1033 is trying to take. So I just also want to put that in context at Chase, right? So 1033 is just coming out. It's not even a final rule. We have over 7,500 apps that connect to our ecosystem today and get data. So that's larger than what most other countries have in terms of an existing open banking ecosystem. So the industry here has made real progress in making sure that we can empower customers and do that in the right way. I will say it's a patchwork because to our screen scraping conversation, a lot of that still happens through screen scraping. There's not standardized way that APIs work. There's not standardized way that data is shared. There's not standard frequency in which data is available. So I can understand the push and pull, but it's that's where I think the Bureau and like largely all the regulators have a key role to play is making sure that we understand the customer mindset here. It's not about the legalese. It's not about what banks want or fintechs want. Truly have to understand what does the customer want and how do we put the customer in control. And I don't think we've done that yet. And that's what we are really looking to do as we move forward here.
Yeah, that's pretty tough to follow up on, Ramon, but why don't you give it a shot on the regulatory end?
Ravi's always hard to follow up on. He's so good. But Ravi is highlighting what I call the unfinished sentence of the regulatory proposal, which is that we have focused a lot on sharing the data, making the data widely available, but there's still risks within that data sharing mandate, if you will, that we have not fully addressed. And not all data packets are the same. Your transaction data is not going to be the same as your account number, right? Or because one allows money movement, one allows payments. The other is just a picture of you that, yes, it can be used by hackers to create synthetic identity, to do all sorts of things, but it's far from cleaning out your account. And I think part of what we need to address from a regulatory perspective is that the proliferation of data needs to be within a regulatory environment that allows controlling the risk commensurate with the data being shared. And we filed a large comment letter that deconstructed those risks. And it was intended really to highlight that the value that we see, the momentum that Ravi talks about in terms of adoption of open banking, for lack of a better term now, can be slowed down if we create too much of a reckless release into the ecosystem of data elements that are dangerous. And one of the metaphors I use is that when it comes to high-risk data, like account numbers that can be used for payments, it's like, you fly a plane within sight or within reach of airports in the continental United States. But to fly an airplane across the ocean, to carry those human beings across the ocean, you need to have a special certification because now you're flying longer. You have less chances to bail out and to take care of any risk that comes up. So you need to look at which parts of the data being released have mitigating factors and which don't, and create a regulatory environment that is commensurate with the data that's being released. Because at the end of the day, if you have a problem with your account, you don't call the fintech. You may not know what the fintech is. They may not even have a phone number. You call your bank. And then the bank is trying to go blind, trying to help you. And if the necessary components are not there to connect the dots, then it becomes very difficult to be able to give consumers the type of experience that Ravi wants to make sure they have.
Ramon and Ravi, thank you so much for this. It has definitely given me a new perspective on open banking. And I have to admit, I am not familiar or was not familiar with the term apnea, but now, you know, I'll be using it left and right and assuming that everybody else knows it and giving them the stare if they don't. Thank you so much to both of you for joining the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I think it's pretty clear that transactional environments of every sort turn on a complex interaction of newcomers and upstarts. Legacy systems provide a point of reference and tested systems, whereas startups take risks that larger companies can't and introduce competition into the marketplace. The key question, of course, is who internalizes the risk of such innovation? And not infrequently, it's the consumer, especially where profit-seeking leads companies to underinvest in protections that could ultimately benefit users of technology. But at the same time, non-action can have costs as well, and legacy systems, when entrenched, can end up hurting consumers through monopolistic or oligopolistic behavior. In areas like open banking, upstarts are again forcing the question. But in a bit of a departure, legacy firms aren't just buying companies, but they're also innovating in their own right. And this is making regulatory proposals and prospective reforms areas where unexpected alliances can arise between industry players and the most progressive of regulators. Now, whether or not this still leads to good policy will be a matter of debate, but make no mistake, debate or not, change makers, big and small, are set for a season of change. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to get your feedback. If you'd like to get in touch, just hit me up at Chris Brummer, DR. That's at C-H-R-I-S-B-R-U-M-M-E-R-D-R. We'd love to hear from you.